to go. It feels like we're on running a little bit of ahead of schedule tonight, but there's no reason to have everybody sit around and wait. And if you know Buck, you know he's not particularly good at sitting around and waiting anyway. So, and to be fair, nor am I. So, we're delighted to welcome you all to the last of our Lenten Suppers and Speaker Series for this year. And as you know, we've been talking about community. Obviously, we're all part of the St. Mary's community, but our first week we talked about how we enriched that feeling of community by the various ministries and other things that are offered here, and we heard wonderful reflections from Seth Schaefer and Sydna Street and Robin Lind. And then the next week we talked about our relationships within the diocese and with the diocese. And we had Andrew Terry here and several other parishioners from St. Peter's Episcopal Church in the East End, and had a number of reflections about the connections and the relationships and the community that builds from St. Mary's with the diocese and with churches in the diocese. And last week we had Reverend Joel Blunk here from Richmond Hill, and we were again talking about our role in the Metropolitan Richmond community here at St. Mary's, and how we might be called to participate in that. And just a quick aside, yesterday at Richmond Hill, they dedicated the Virginia Historical Society marker for Richmond Hill, and Bob Hetherington and Ashley Cameron and Andrew Moore and I were there, and I noticed that the name of Richmond Hill when it was still a convent was Monte Maria, which made me think, of course, Mount Mary, so that seems like there's yet another connection. But one of the points that a couple of the speakers made is that when you talk about praying for the city of Richmond, if you think of the city not as a legal entity, but the way it would look from the sky, looking down, and how you don't see the lines between the city and the counties, you don't see the lines between neighborhoods, you don't see who lives where, you just see that we're all part of this one big area, and somehow we have a connection to each other. And it's hard to think, well, where would you draw the line? So that's just another way of thinking about how we at St. Mary's are part of the metropolitan Richmond community. And tonight we move on to how we at St. Mary's also have relationships in the greater Episcopal Church and in the Anglican Communion, which is worldwide. There are Anglican or Episcopal churches on every continent, maybe not Antarctica, but all over. And so our speaker tonight is Buck Blanchard, and he will talk to us about those things. Buck works at the Diocese of Virginia, but also recently with the Episcopal Church, and I'll let him tell you more about that. So from right here, those relationships continue to grow. So, honey?
I'm talking here, if that's okay, and I know my only rule tonight is for me to be done by 7. That has been made very clear. So we will be finished by 7 o'clock, and everyone will be on the board. Okay, finish with one. If you want to interrupt and ask a question, please do. I'm going to start off like I always do with a quick prayer. Many of you have prayed this before, but this is the way I like to start any sort of gathering. The Lord be with you.
And also to you.
Let us pray. May God bless you with comfort, with discomfort, and easy answers, half-truths, and superficial relationships, so that you may live deep within your heart. May God bless you with anger and injustice, oppression, and exploitation of people, so that you may work for justice, freedom, and peace. May God bless you with tears to shed for those who suffer from pain, rejection, starvation, and war, so that you may reach out your hand to comfort them, turning their pain into joy. And may God bless you with enough foolishness to believe that you can make a difference in this world, doing what others claim cannot be done. And may the blessing of God who creates, redeems, and sanctifies be upon you and on all who you love and pray for this day and forevermore.
Amen.
big fans of the Tudors on television. And that's what we do now. We binge watch the Tudors for, you know, fun and exciting evening. And we're learning all about Henry VIII. And everybody knows about Henry VIII and Elizabeth and Mary and all that, but we're getting a real solid dose of detail about Henry VIII. One thing I now know about Henry VIII, at least according to this show, is he was one mean son of a gun. He didn't like somebody, he killed him. He didn't like somebody else, he'd chop off their head. He didn't like somebody else, he'd burn them at the stake. Very serious dude. He also, though, was the person that created the Anglican Church. Remember the story, he has his first wife, and then he meets Anne, he wants to get rid of his first wife. He goes to the Pope said, not a chance, not happening. He said, this is the abbreviated version, and thank goodness Robin's not here, because he would correct me. Okay, that's fine. If you're going to let me do what I want to do, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to create my own church. And that became the English church. And one of the first things he did was he said, I need all the priests out there to swear allegiance to me. Because we're not swearing allegiance to the Pope anymore. Because we're not the Catholic Church anymore. We're now the Anglican Church. The English Church. So that was sort of in the 1830s. Fast forward another 60, 70 years, Queen Elizabeth got married in between, where he went back to Catholicism, and then finally Queen Elizabeth comes back in, and she reigns and really solidifies this Anglican communion thing, this English church. Queen Elizabeth died in 1603. So what happens in 1607 that everyone in this room can know about?
Jamestown,
right? So we finally have a permanent English settlement in the New World, just 4 years after Queen Elizabeth died after reigning for a good long time.
But you know what I learned today? Where was the first Anglican service in the New World?
If you asked me that yesterday, I would have said Jamestown.
Massachusetts.
Was it in
North Carolina?
Plymouth. Right. All of you guessed wrong. It took place in 1579 in California by the chaplain who was accompanying Sir Francis Drake as the circumnavigator. They stopped in California, one thing that it was had an Anglican service.
That's a charity
question. But when you really think about a permanent group of people who settle and began worshiping and having an Anglican service is 1607 in Jamestown. All right? Then the church continues to grow here as more and more folks come over. And we're all Anglicans. We're all part of the Church of England. We're all that sort of thing. Okay? Well, then we have this nasty thing called the American Revolution. And we're revolting against the king. We're revolting against English rule, and we become independent. Okay? Everybody knows that. What do you think happens with the church? The Anglican Church is here, and you know, that's the church. It's not government, it has anything to do with government, does it? So what happens here after we fight the American Revolution?
Well, we're not aligned with the English Church because the English
Church. Right, and our priests, our Americans, would have to swear allegiance to the king of England. And we said, hey, we can do that. We just fought a war, so we wouldn't have to do that. Sure, we're not doing that. But this whole service, the liturgy, the richness of it, the tradition, and everything we know of as church, we still wanted that here. So what we did, what the church here in the United States did, was say, okay, we're not going to be the Anglican Church anymore. We're not going to call ourselves that, because Anglican means English. We're not English anymore, we're Americans. So we're going to change our name. We're going to look up a fancy word for bishop in Greek, which is
Episcopus.
So we'll call ourselves the Episcopal Church. And we'll be different. But we still want to be connected with the English Church, because that's where we came from. We don't want to swear allegiance. We don't want to do that. But we want to be connected. So that was really the beginning of what we now call the Anglican Communion. It's a communion of folks who came out of this Anglican tradition but have established churches elsewhere where those churches aren't beholden to the King of England or the Queen of England. They're their own separate church entities. But they operate in a family. And that family we call the Anglican Communion. The largest Christian group in the world, grouping, is the Catholic Church. The second largest grouping in the world is the Eastern Orthodox Church. The third largest grouping in the world is the Anglican Communion on the Christian side. There are 80 million people who are Anglicans, Episcopalians, one name or another, in 167 countries around the world. That's our network of people who are all part of our extended Anglican Communion family.
We're going to ask you to pass these out. So everyone's going to get a map tonight,
because I love maps, and if you get a map in your hands, I'll make you feel good. This is a map that shows where the Anglican Communion is. Now, the way the Anglican Communion, of course, grew from the church in England and then the church in the United States is how did the church get spread around the world? How did the Anglican Church get spread around the world?
The empire, exactly.
Colonization. So the English go out and they set up, they colonize countries. They bring their church is established there. And so all around the world, you're going to find places where, in that country, there is the Anglican Church of, let's say, Tanzania. There's the Anglican Church of Kenya. But who else was eventually was colonizing the world?
Spain.
Fast forward then. Think about the late 1700s, the 1800s.
I didn't hear the question.
What was the question again?
Who besides the English were colonizing the world in the 19th and 20th century?
The Muslims.
Who else?
Spain.
This is fascinating. This is really fascinating.
Us.
Us! Oh, we got okay. We were! And so everywhere we went, we didn't establish the Anglican Church of somewhere. We established the Episcopal Church. So if you look on that map, most of the places around the world are called Anglican churches, but there are plenty of places that are called Episcopal churches. In places like Liberia. Philippines, Brazil, places where we were sending missionaries, even if we weren't colonizing the country. I visited Brazil a couple of years ago, and they were getting ready to celebrate their 125th anniversary. They said, it's really cool. Let you know the story about it, because we were established as a church here in Brazil by two missionaries who came from a seminary, and I don't know exactly where it is. I think it's called Alexandria, Virginia. That's how the church in Brazil got started. But it's the Episcopal Church of Brazil, not the Anglican Church. So, we are part of this huge global network called the Anglican Communion. But let me dial back and start small and grow back up together quickly. So, we're St. Mary's Parish here. We're part of the Diocese of Virginia. There are 180 churches now in the Diocese of Virginia. And that's effectively the northern part of Virginia. Following James River East and sort of 64, going west, and anything north of that is the Diocese of Virginia. We actually also have a Diocese of Southern Virginia and a Diocese of Southwestern Virginia. In the Episcopal Church, this combination of dioceses that are here, so we're one of 109 dioceses in what we call TEC, the Episcopal Church. Okay, everybody with me so far? There are about 1.8 million Episcopalians in the Episcopal Church, and 7,000 parishes, something like that. I want to get some nomenclature straight. When most people think of our church, the big church, they call it the national church. Everybody calls it, what's the national church? So you sort of have the local church, you have the diocesan church, and then you have the national church. Well, people who work for the national church hate that. They say, you can't call us a national church. Well, of course you can. That's what you are, right? You're the national church. You're the church of the United States. You know where the Church of the United States operates today? This is the Episcopal Church. It operates in all 50 states. Plus, this is our church now. And you'll see why we don't call it the National Church. It operates in all 50 states. Plus, Puerto Rico, Colombia, the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Venezuela, Curacao, Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, Switzerland, Haiti, Honduras, Micronesia, Taiwan, and the Virgin Islands. Now you know why they don't like to call us to call it the National Church. Because that's where this church operates. And that church, our church operates in all those different places as the Episcopal Church. But most people will call it the National Church or the Episcopal Church USA. So it's much broader than that. And those are places generally where, well, a lot of different reasons that we operate in those various places. One other piece of nomenclature is, you'll hear people sometimes say, what do the people at 815 think about that? Anybody heard that before? What do people at 815 think about that? The Episcopal Church headquarters is an office building in New York City. They have different people who work around the world, but most of the folks who work for the Episcopal Church work in this office building in New York City, which is located at 815 Second Avenue. And the only thing on the outside of the building are these three huge numbers that say 815. So when people talk about the staff who runs the Episcopal Church, they usually talk about 815. It's sort of like here in Virginia where people say, what's going on at Mayo House? Mayo House is the headquarters of the office and the staff and vice versa. And it's just a. Okay. Everybody got all that? The parish into diocese, into the Episcopal Church, and the Episcopal Church is one of the provinces around the world that you see on your map. Anywhere you see a little tiny 35, gotta have good glasses on to see them. That is a place that is directly connected with the Episcopal Church, part of our big. But there are 43 other provinces around the world that together constitute these 80 million people worshiping in the Anglican tradition in 160 million years. Here's the point of all of that. When we travel around the world, 99 times out of 100, 99.9% of the time out of 100, we're not traveling to places who haven't heard the gospel. We're not traveling to visit people who aren't Christian. We're not even traveling to visit people who aren't Anglicans. We're reaching out to the world, to the rest of our family that exists in all sorts of different places around the planet. And I don't care whether they're worshiping in Dinka or in Swahili or in Zandi or in Spanish or in 100 other different languages, you can follow the liturgy because it's the same liturgy in every single one of those places. Just in a different language. And the opportunity that we have is to recognize that, this is like having an extended family. And it's like having folks who are already are all over the world and who are hungry to get to know their family members. And what you have now is a world that wants to connect with the rest of the world, including the U.S. Church. And the opportunities for us as a community to connect with the rest of the world are virtually endless. You've got a very brilliant group of people out there that want to get to know us generally. And in many cases, they live and work and worship in areas of the world that are incredibly different. And one of the questions I get when I'm in a difficult place is, in a nice way, they'll say it in a much nicer way than this. But their real question is, you come from America. You come from the Episcopal Church in America. Yeah. Where the hell have you guys been? You have a visit. We would love for you to come here and learn what we do and tell us what you do. And go all over there in America and have a great time. But you're not leaving. You're not getting to know the rest of your family. And the point they make to us all the time is, I'm Joe Schmo in South Sudan. I really want to get to know you guys. I really want to get to know you as a church. My annual income is about $300. It's really tough for me to buy plane tickets in New York. Yeah, I think you might be able to convince some of the folks back in the church in the U.S. to buy plane tickets and come visit us here. That's our opportunity. And it's as boundless as that map. So within Virginia, we have churches who are doing incredible work in places like close by, Haiti, Cuba, El Salvador, Panama, the Dominican Republic. Lots of groups go down to those sorts of places. We have a number of different churches. Again, this is just the Diocese of Virginia who visit Tanzania. Weezy and I are going to be in Tanzania in June, going to one place that has been visited by a lot of U.S. churches. But we're also going to spend a couple of days on the island of Zanzibar, which sounds very fancy. Zanzibar is like 98.5% Muslim. And yet the Christian church still operates there. And not just the Christian church, but the Anglican church. And the bishop and his canon are looking forward to telling us and demonstrating to us how the Anglican church operates in a part of the world that's 98% Muslim and how they get along. You know, it's fascinating. A few years ago, I was in Pakistan. It's a really strange feeling that I don't think we fully grasp on a day-to-day basis how comfortable it is for us to be in a country where we're in majority. The Christian faith in this country is the majority. And there's a whole lot of easiness that comes along with that. That disappears when you go to a place like Pakistan. But you are a tiny, tiny, tiny army. And yet, you know who operates in Pakistan? The Anglican Church. There's really cool people doing incredibly interesting things that you never even think of. We have churches that are working and doing good work in places like Ghana, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Louise and I will also visit, South Sudan, South Africa. The Philippines, where I actually spent a year living and working with the church there. Sri Lanka. It's everywhere on that map. And so our challenge is to figure out how do we connect to the place in the world that God has enabled us to connect with and where we have some sort of a natural affinity, where there's some reason to connect. And then get out and actually visit those. Because to see what they do and experience what they experience is what we're called to do by getting out and living in the rest of the world. Like I said in here in an earlier talk, you never really love somebody until you get to know them. And once you really get to know them, it's really hard not to love them. But you got to get to know them. And the way you get to know them is to visit them. Because they're not visiting here. They don't have the resources to do that. And if you go and if you get involved, the things that happen in your world change. You hear it all the time, right? No one ever comes back on a mission trip and doesn't say, this changed me more than, I got more out of this than I did. Every single time. Everybody goes on a mission trip and comes back and goes, those were the most incredibly friendly, warm, hospitable people that I've ever met. Every single time. People ask me, what have you learned by all your international travel? I've learned how to be a better host. It's like the Jehovah's Witness guy. I told the story before. Jehovah's Witness guy. I told the story of a guy in Tanzania. I said, Jehovah's Witness is here. They come in and knock on the door. He goes, oh, what do you do when they knock on your door? I said, we hide behind the couch. And I'm not the same. I'm like, oh, boy, you're so sorry now. You didn't buy them for tea. I mean, why would you buy them for tea? They're there. They're God's children. They're knocking on your door. They just want to get to know you. Why not have a little chat?
But we don't understand America.
And he said, you're right, I don't understand America. Because what we would do here in Tanzania is we bring them in, we find some food, we find a cup of tea, we exchange. You don't hear that story, you don't get that feeling until you actually sit down. In some far-flung place in the world that sounds really strange, but it's not strange at all. people around the world are interested in the exact same things that we are. You ask them, what's the top of your list? What worries you most? What do they say first? So you're talking to somebody my age.
Kids.
Kids! Right? Number one thing is I want my kids to have a better opportunity than I have. I want them to have a good education, and that's my, I want them to be safe. Right? Second thing is health care. I want there to be a clinic that somebody can take care of me or my kids or whatever when mm-hmm. I have. I want clean water. Mm-hmm. Right? I want, we don't have that issue here. I want a good nutritious food. I want to be able to eat and drink and live and have my kids taken care of and have the ability to cure disease if I get it. And then I can do my thing. I can be a farmer, I can be a seamstress, I can be whatever, but I gotta have those basic necessities. It's no different than what we would say here. I just say it in a different language. And yet when you're talking to people, you can learn some unbelievable things. I'll tell you two stories real quick and then I'll start with questions. I got with a group of women in Tanzania one time, and I said, we were just kind of hanging out at night, and sort of said, you can ask me any question you want to. And they said, okay, that's great. Why do Americans hate their parents so much? They said, yeah. You know, your parents can bring you up, they take care of you. And here, when our parents get old, we put them back in, we take care of them. In America, you stick them in a home. In some states, you never visit them. They're never visit them. And you visit them, you know, once a month, and stop by for lunch at their church. Why do you do that? Well, that's a really hard question. I'm not sure how to answer that question. Those are the sorts of discussions you get from real human beings, from real questions, and they see our life, and we can see their life from completely different perspectives in ways that really cause us to, you know, have to learn some things that we wouldn't normally think about. And that's the fun, that's the joy of getting to know another community, another person, here in Richmond, just as it is across the world, is it sparks a curiosity and an empathy to actually learn, why does someone do what they do? Why do they behave in that way? And to do that, to really understand, you have to understand their background, who they are, what they think, where they came from, what their religion, their culture, their geography, all that sort of thing. It's fascinating to be able to learn that and then say, and then be able to say to them, I heard this on the radio the other day, who knows the six most important words for a healthy marriage? Or any healthy relationship, they turn into marriage. The six words you need to know if you want to maintain a good marriage.
Let's do it three times.
I hear where you're coming from. I understand where you're coming from.
Please forgive me.
That's not for this. You know I was wrong. I'm really looking forward to St. Mary's connecting in whatever way it's appropriate for St. Mary's to connect to the world. Every church is different. Every relationship is different. You're not trying, though, as you set these sorts of things up, to go over somewhere and say, I'm going to build a wall. We're doing that in America. We don't need to go build a wall in some places. We don't need to necessarily paint a school. There are projects that are included in mission relationships. But I think of those as sort of like a crutch. It's a tool to get you to start talking to the people that you're visiting and to start interacting with folks. And you know, that's it. Put the hammer down every once in a while. Pick up a cup of coffee and say, tell me about yourself. I want to learn about you. Just talk to me. And those interactions wind up resulting in an increased understanding that we can have of people who look and talk and eat differently than we do, but they're really not. And it's a blessing to be able to do that, and I look forward to all of us being able to get out and get the mix. Questions? Comments? Yes?
Just as an observation.
space. The whole thing about the mission involvement or local churches taking groups to different places to serve and do things is a relatively recent phenomenon in the church. And I wonder, what do you think is creating this different spirit or the wish that...
Well, a couple things. One is the how easy it is to travel. Right? And we've become affluent enough, and although airline prices can be ridiculous sometimes compared to historical norms, they're not ridiculous. Also, the increased communications means you don't always have to travel. You can travel and establish a relationship if you can actually use communications, especially in this day and age, to keep a relationship open. I mean, think about 50 years ago, people just fly off to Zanzibar, even for vacation, and now it's pretty easy to do. You know, I'm a gold card holder of Sheba Miles, which is Ethiopian Airlines. It's the only airline that I've ever attained gold status. And I love going to the desk and they say, "What, may I have your Sheba Miles number?" Why did that? I know it. I'm interrupting. But I think that's a big piece of it. But I also think comes from that general hunger, and this is particularly true with younger folks these days, to understand and connect with the rest of the world. And I think there's also this this feeling that still is pervasive in some ways that, oh my gosh, if we have to take a mission trip, I got to travel with the Bible, and I got to talk Jesus, and I got to proselytize, and I got to, you know. And that's not what these relationships are about. Right? They're about connecting. They already have the gospel. Right? Someone's saying, we don't need to go save them. They already got a savior. They take care of that. We're just going to connect and get to know them. And that does such a big thing for us as we're all at the same time. Well, that was the intro.
What was a switch for you, Bob, that said, this is what I'm going to do? Was it a complete change, or had you drifted there, or was there?
No, I mean, actually, very lately, that she took the story so many times, she's going to die. We used to get it. She sat me down at breakfast one day and said, this is a very short version. Buck, you love to travel, you love the third world, you're a Peace Corps volunteer, you love the Episcopal Church, you want to get involved in this whole thing, and you sit down here. What she said was, I love you, but every morning I have to sit down here and have breakfast with a man who's chicken to live his life. Because what you want to do is get out of the world. And at the time, I was running a business that installed granite countertops and high-end houses. But you've got to be kidding me. That's what you're doing. Explain it to me.
Somebody's
got to say it. You go to the Peace Corps, the Episcopal Church, the Third World, living in Brussels, the Love and Mission and Outreach, so let's put in granite countertops and as she just did also with the National Church. Whoops, there we go again. With 815. So I've been doing this for 10 years now where I have had the opportunity to travel to other places all around the world and then come back and talk to churches in the Diocese of Virginia about that. 99% of that travel has been funded by an outside donor. And that outside donor recently said, kind of our suggestion, gosh, I've been funding you to travel for 10 years all around the world, and your sales market is the northern half of the state of Virginia. I kind of wasted my investment. Why don't you figure out how to sell this to the church at large, which is now what I'm doing for the Episcopal Church office in New York, doing that very good thing for half of my time, is going out and talking to parishes and dioceses and groups throughout the country who may not have a mission and outreach person on their diocese. You may be very interested in connecting with a place like the Eastern Congo or South Sudan or Tanzania, but they don't have anybody to get started. They don't have anybody to hold their hand. They don't have cheerily. They don't have anybody to say, that's what you want to do, Dad, but that's what we're doing. Because, as Ashley knows all too well, the line we use is, if you really feel called by God to be involved in this ministry, in this place, do you think that's God? Like capital G, God, calling you. You know, the good answer, the best answer is not,
let me think about it, or gosh, I really don't have the time, or heaven forbid, I have to check in the vestry. You know, the answer to that is yes. I'm doing it. Let's figure out how to do that. And my job is to help people make that happen. Other questions? Yes,
could you explain or clarify the situation with the African church and that great way?
We're going to need a longer meeting for that one. but real quickly, the African society is incredibly conservative. And that's very place to place, but in general, we want to homogenize it. They're incredibly conservative group, all kinds of various issues. So the idea of having gay rights, gay marriage, and that is just completely anathema to them. And so they've had a really difficult time with the Episcopal Church and other churches who take a more liberal stance, communicating with and being in communion with those churches, not just an apostolic. And effectively what happened here, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, was that there was a conservative group of U.S. churches as well, who said, we don't want to be part of the Episcopal Church because they're too liberal. We're going to break away. And some of them who broke away had partnered with some of those conservative African churches who have similar ideas around those sorts of social issues. But it's incredibly complex. But what's great about this sort of travel, the places where Weezy and I are going, we're going to Tanzania, to Zanzibar, which is an eastern kind of a place called Goma. Unbelievably conservative churches. I mean, we put them right at Willow Rock. But they want to get to know us. And they're at the point where they're saying, you know, we're going to disagree on some stuff. But just because we disagree on even some big stuff, doesn't mean we can't get to know each other so that maybe we can love each other. What I like to tell them is, you know, the person who I disagree with the most and the most violently, I live with. So just because you disagree with somebody,
you can't love them.
So what are we doing here? What are we doing in this travel? We're communicating. And the thing that I love to hear on a mission trip more than anything, and love to say, once you exchange the story back and forth, here's what we think, here's what we think, here's what we think, here's what we think, is to have somebody say to you, or have me say to them, really? I had no idea. That means you're communicating, and that means you fall in love.
You're doing a lot of work in Sudan.
Yes.
What's happening to all that with the defense civil war and all the struggles going on? What's happening to the work that you've been part of?
Again, much longer story, because South Sudan is a mess right now. But there's still quite a number of churches who are working there. I'll probably go in July to the place that Dice of Jenny and my family's connected with.
It's out there.
That's what's called Cuba, which is in South Sudan. But there are a number of churches throughout the United States who work in South Sudan. They have sort of a grouping, which they call AFRAC, so they're the Episcopal Church of South Sudan and Sudan. But it's a difficult place right now. And there are 100,000 people in South Sudan right now. They're probably 2 weeks away from dying of starvation. And another million who aren't far behind. It's one of those wars in the world right now. It's really. They're dying from starvation. Most of that starvation comes not from lack of rain, although that contributes to it. It comes from violence. And it's really hard to eat if you can't plant your crop because someone will shoot you. And it's really hard to even get your crop to eat if when you walk out to get your crop, you get raped. So it's the violence itself that causes it, that adds to a difficult food situation.
Well, is the Episcopal Church particularly under siege there? Or are they being singled out and targeted for?
No, the thing about South Sudan, and I'm going to stop this in a second, is most places in the world where you go, the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, it's a big dog. I mean, it's a big dog by a factor of a lot. And then the Episcopal Church, the Lutheran Church, and the Presbyterian Church, and all, are all these little players, sort of bit players as well. In South Sudan, the Episcopal Church and the Catholic Church are the same size. So what happens in that society is people look to government to provide all those things we talked about: peace, food, education, healthcare. And the government in South Sudan right now is a train wreck. You're not getting any of those services, for the most part, from a stable, organized government. So where are they going next? To go to the church. And if you think about a church, it's a marvelous distribution system, right? You got an office in every village. So what we're trying to do is bolster the Episcopal Church there to be more effective in providing social services, but also care, pastoral care, all around, throughout the whole country. And it's one of those places where it's really easy to say, I'm just giving up. This is too hard, it's too violent, it's too difficult. But, you know, we're called to serve the least of these. Not the least of these that are sort of bad off. The least of the least of these, they're like really bad off. And for me, that's not so bad. We can't say, oh, we're called to serve the least of these unless things get really bad, then we just bang it. You know, that's not an answer we can give as Christians.
Would you work with the state department on issues like that? Because Sudan's been going
50 years. So, there's actually a project we're working on, Peace and Reconciliation Project in South Sudan, that's being funded by USAID. And that's being pushed out through reconciliation training the trainers, and then having priests go out and be agents of reconciliation throughout the country, through the network of the Episcopal Church, the Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church, the Presbyterian Church, all together as the Sudan Council of Churches. So, I'm not saying you solve it, but it's a...
You can answer questions.
Okay. Yes.
Looking on your DACs, are you aware, has there ever been a genealogy of these DACs? Who belong to them, where they came from? And the reason I ask, I remember, previous parish, like, we were celebrating our 300th anniversary, and somebody in the parish from the original did some sort of a genealogy. And found our primary parish in England, and we went and did it,
I don't know a genealogy project like that per se, but one of the things that we're working on as a modern church right now is an asset map where eventually you'll be able to take your cursor on a computer and drag it to Tanzania, and so show you every church that works there, link back to there, and around.
We've got to have a lot of cousins over here somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got plenty of them. Information like that is tough to gather because it may be shocking. It is shocking for a lot of people in New York that people don't actually wake up and go to the National Church website to feed them information. That's not what we do. That's way down on the list. So getting information from all around the world is tough. And Ashley knows that better than we do. Yes, ma'am.
So is there any place that you've wanted to go yet that you haven't gone to?
There is a bishop he's the bishop of all the French-speaking places in the world who are Anglicans, where the Anglican Church operates. He lives in Europe, he lives in Paris, but he's American. He lives over there. And I asked him a couple years ago, okay, you got all these French-speaking places, and he's not speaking a little French. Most people don't speak French, and most people who are in mission outreach don't speak French. So where is the most, the place that needs the most attention you could possibly think of that we should consider? You know what he said? Mauritius. Which is an island over here in the Indian Ocean that's a pure resort. Oh, yeah. I couldn't sell it to Bishop Johnson. there are a lot of places. There's a lot going on in India. The whole Asian situation is one. Other places in the Middle East. I told the story over here to the seniors meeting. Back, I went to the hearing school in Salt, Jordan, where the Episcopal Church specializes in working with kids who are hearing impaired or deafblind. Most of the staff consists of kids who come on a gap year from Europe, so they're 18, 19, 20 years old. And there are all these kids running around, and all these young people from all around the world signing with them and teaching stuff. It's
incredible ministry. I think the answer to your question generally, though, is I'm ready to go any place I've never been before tomorrow. And the stranger, the farther, the more off the grid it is, the better. Because I don't think it's right for someone with my attitude to spend my time going to places that already get visited. It's important to go to the places that want to get visited, where nobody's. You imagine how you live. It's like when I talk with her. I'm here for the Anglican Communion. I'm very faithful. I'm good people in our community. I always know you. Once you get to know us as a society, no others. Those are the places.
Quick them up, real quick. I see from the map that we have churches in Korea, the most dangerous place in the world. North Korea?
Not in North Korea, okay. In South Korea. But South Korea is actually incredibly vibrant Anglican church. The number one church in the world that sends out missionaries out to the world is the United States. The second one is England. The third one is South Korea. South Korea is about the third most missionary all around the world. It's a very vibrant, active church, and we have three congregations here. We just had a rector who has retired. He's gone back for his first day of his retirement back to South Korea to work with the Archbishop there. Mm-hmm. Because he's lived there here so long, he's sort of forgotten what took back home.
Sure.
Not North Korea.
Misread the map.
Yeah.
Well, it does say on it, actually said on that.
Does it?
I don't think every church is actually operating this.
I think that could be a mistake.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm telling you, this is fun stuff. It's absolutely fascinating. And we are citizens of the world whether we like it or not. We just are. Because we're part of the world. And you know, it's probably it ever worked. But it's certainly going to work in today's age to say, we're going to ring fence this community, this group, this country. We're not going to connect with anybody else out there. You just can't do it. And what's great for us is we don't have to invent. We don't have to create.